An Osho Talk. The great Zen master, Tahui. Reflections on the transformation of an intellectual to enlightenment. Number 13.
Nothing to be given. There has never been anything to give to people. Only folks who have been able to point out the road for people. An ancient worthy said, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. Buddha was someone who had mastered adaptation. In the course of 49 years, in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma, he guided people according to their individual faculties. Thus he preached with one voice through all realms, while sentient beings each obtained benefits according to their kind. It's like one gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. Buddha is also like this. If he had had the intent to create benefit in all realms, then this would have been preaching the Dharma egotistically. To want to cause myriad beings to gain deliverance according to their kind, isn't this, after all, impossible? Haven't you read how Shariputra, at the assembly where the perfection of wisdom was preached, asked Manjusri, don't all Buddhas, the Tathagatas, awaken to the realm of truth? Manjusri said, no, Shariputra, even the Buddhas cannot be found. How could there be Buddhas who awaken to the realm of truth? Even the realm of truth cannot be found. How could it be realized by the Buddhas? See how those two men spurred each other on this way. When did they ever set their minds on anything? All the Buddhas and all the patriarchs since antiquity have had a style like this in helping people. It's just that later descendants have lost the essence of the school and set up their own individual sects, making up strange things and concocting marvels.
It is beautiful when Tahui simply quotes the words of the awakened ones. The moment he brings himself in, the whole glory and the splendor is lost. Although he is trying hard, to pretend that he is enlightened, but he cannot hide it. He cannot hide it from the eyes which can look deep into his very self. It will be a great event when he realizes his pretensions. It will not be difficult for him to become enlightened. All that he has to know, that he does not know. And that will be the immediate transformation. He knows too much. And his experience is absolutely nil. But I hope slowly, slowly he's coming closer to realize, because now he is not making his own statements more, just quoting the Buddha's. The first sutra is a very ancient one. Even it has not originated with Gautama Buddha. Perhaps all the awakened ones have emphasized the fact, they have to, because it is so real and so significant to be told to the people. That the master cannot give anything to you. If he could, he would have given you everything. But as far as enlightenment is concerned, it is absolutely your individual, private territory. Nobody can interfere with it. Then what is the purpose of the master? His purpose is to take away things from you which you think you are. His purpose is negative. He simply thinks your false conceptions. And once all false concepts are taken away from you, that which is real illuminates in all its beauty. He has not given you anything, but he has removed all the obstructions, all the hindrances which you were clinging to. The moment you will become enlightened, you will know that this experience has been always with you. Just your eyes were closed. The master tries in every way arbitrary devices to wake you up. Once you are awake, nothing has to be said because you are seeing yourself. And the experience of enlightenment is exactly the same. Tahui is quoting the ancient sutra. There has never been anything to give to people. Only fogs who have been able to point out the road for people. The actual words of Buddha are, I cannot travel further. Not that I don't want, but it is simply not in the nature of things. Able to point out the road for people. An ancient worthy said, having some attainment is the jackal's elf, having no attainment is the lion's roar. On the path there are many movements. When you will feel, I have attained it, I have got it. Remember a criterion that whenever that idea arises in you that I have got it, you are without any doubt wrong. Because the very idea I have got it means an ego achievement. You are there and some goal has been achieved. It may be some beautiful experience, but it is still illusory. Hence, the ancient worthy says, having some attainment is the jackal's elf. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. On the path the moment comes, that the seeker is lost. And the desire to attain anything leaves you. As you are not there, who is going to attain? When you are so simple and innocent that you cannot manage to say, I, there is no question of attainment, because there is no attaining mind. But this is the attainment. Losing everything, even the seeker, you have found what the seeker was seeking. But now there is nobody to declare it. then comes just a lion's roar, a simple recognition. With no words, you explode into a rejoicing, into a dance. All is lost. And when you are standing in a state of utter nothingness, from the other side, all is gained. But those words do not apply anymore. And you cannot say, I have attained it. It is simple recognition that it has been always with you. Hence the lion's roar. Buddha was someone who had mastered adaptation in the course of 49 years in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma. He guided people according to their individual faculties. Taohui's statement is true. Buddha does not believe in the collective mind. He believes in individual consciousness. Perhaps he is the first man to declare that the very existence of God deprives man from his individuality. His reason for denying God is not theological. He is not an atheist. His denial for God is to declare that the individual consciousness is the highest growth in existence. Nobody is above it. All the religions think that God created the world, He created man, He created woman, and everything that is in the world. To Buddha, it is a very insulting, humiliating idea. If God can create, He can uncreate any moment. You are just puppets in the hands of a puppeteer. Then all talk of individuality and freedom and enlightenment is just futile. God has to be removed as a hypothesis, because He is the greatest hindrance to to your individuality. Nietzsche recognized it after 25 centuries in a different context, but the realization is the same. He said, God is dead and now man is free. If God is still alive, man cannot be free. How can you be free? The very idea of all the religions creating men out of mud, that's what the meaning of humus, from which comes the word human. That is also the meaning of Adam. Adam means mud. He made Adam out of mud and then breathed life into them. It is almost like creating a toy. What freedom, what individuality, what liberation exist for a puppet? Buddha dropped the hypothesis of God, and 25 centuries before, it was a great rebellious idea. Nietzsche was only a thinker. He could not influence many people. But Buddha dropped God in favor that man's consciousness can grow unhindered. That his privacy is sacred and nobody can enter into it. The religions say God is watching you every moment. In the eyes of God, you don't have any privacy. I have heard about a nun who used to take a bath in her bathroom with closed doors, but always keeping her clothes on. Other nuns became a little suspicious. Is she a little crazy or what? So they asked her, what is the matter? The doors are closed. You can remove your clothes. She said, what? God is omniscient. He looks every moment in every place. And you are suggesting me to be naked before God? But the poor nun did not understand this, that if God's eyes can penetrate walls, they can penetrate clothes. They can penetrate your skeleton. The very idea of God is inhuman. And Buddha was the first man to recognize the fact that until God exists, man will remain a slave. God has to be completely dropped as an useless hypothesis. Then man is absolutely free, individual, has his own private world of consciousness and realization. And any master worth calling to be a master always takes each individual and teaches him according to his potentialities, according to the stage where he is. This creates sometimes discrepancies, contradictions, but they cannot be avoided because it is impossible to talk to each individual. For example, I have to talk to you all, and I am not only talking to you. What I am saying to you is going to reach around the world to all of my people. When I am talking to you, I am also talking to them. As far as I am concerned, they are as much present to me as you are. But it creates a problem. I am saying something which may be applicable to a certain individual and may not be applicable to somebody else. In their past lives, they have grown different individualities, and they have come to different points. Just the last night we saw Maitreya did not say anything to Sudhana, but just a finger which was absolutely absurd, unrelated to anything, but he clicked his fingers and something transpired through that small gesture. Sudhana became enlightened. He was already ready. Just standing on the borderline. And this simple gesture positive. But there are thick skulls. You go on hammering on them. And they think some kind of massage is being done. You go on telling them the most profound truths, and they think it is a great entertainment. Enlightenment to them is nothing but a curiosity. They don't want to become enlightened, but they want to understand perhaps sometime. It may be a good dimension to explore. One great master from Sri Lanka was dying, and he has called all his disciples, and his last words were that you have been listening for almost half a century. But you go on listening, accumulating knowledge, and nothing seems to change in your being. So as a last resort, I have decided that those who want to become enlightened, I will take with myself. I am dying, they will have to die with me. So if anyone is really interested, stand up. Thousands of monks, and they started looking at each other, that you are senior, you should stand up, that you are a great knower, you should stand up, that you are so learned in scriptures, you give such beautiful sermons, now is the time, get up. But nobody was getting up. The old man said, I don't have much time. Then a man raised his hand. But he also did not get up. The old man said, just raising the hand won't do. Stand up. The man said, forgive me. But I have many other things to do first. I am raising my hand to inquire because you will be gone and I don't know anybody else who can show me the way. You just insert, tell me if someday my works are finished, my complicated affairs are settled, I may follow, but right now, please forgive me. Don't misunderstand my hand. That's why I'm not standing, only the hand is standing. I don't want to become enlightened right now. But I would like to know the right path. The old man said, for half a century, I have been talking about the right path, and you have not understood it. How you can understand within few minutes, because my time has come. But this has given me a great insight that your curiosity, inquiry was not for enlightenment. It was a kind of spiritual entertainment. So there are different people. There are people who are ready. They need just a small help. Just a dip saddle. And there are people who will not budge from their state of affairs. Even if all the Buddhas of the past and the present and the future were trying to make them enlightened. Nobody can make you enlightened unless it has become your own innermost longing. And individuals differ. Hence, Gautam Buddha was always giving instructions to individuals. He was speaking in big assemblies of thousands of monks, but he was answering to a particular individual his question. Or he was saying something to a person who was not even aware that it is being said to him. But the person who is ready will catch it immediately. Whether he understands that it is especially for him, it will start working in his being. Because of differences in individuals, the teaching cannot be a philosophical system. It cannot be logical, non-contradictory. It has to be multidimensional and Tahui is right when he says that he guided people according to their individual faculties. He is talking about Gautam Buddha. It seems he has come to a little sense. He is no more calling him the pale face, the old barbarian. through all realms, while sentient beings each obtain benefits according to their kind, it is like one gust of the east wind. The quotation is from Gautam Buddha, but so beautiful and so poetic. One gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. Just when I come in and I see you bending down, I remember the statement of Gautam Buddha. One gust of the east wind and all the grasses bend down. A man of enlightenment is nothing but a gust of the east wind. Just his being present is enough for those who are capable of some intelligence, who are not prejudiced, who are open and available like the open sky, and who are as innocent as the trees, as the grasses. It is irresistible not to bow down. You are not stone statues. But there are idiots in the world. Just few days before, there were 70 people from Times of India group of papers. This is the biggest organization of papers, the biggest network in India, and the oldest. The owners were here. But except one person, the owner, who has been in love with me for long, when he was a small child, and I used to stay in their house in Calcutta. He wanted to become a sannyasin. He had been before here in the ashram for a few days to meditate. But his father is very much against me. For two reasons his father is against me. That dead boy is his only son. And they are one of the topmost super rich people in India. And he was afraid if he becomes a sannyasin, then who is going to take over his great empire? And the fear that he may start helping the movement with his money. And secondly, he was angry with me, although we had not even quarreled or harmed each other. He was so afraid of me that when I used to stay in their house, because his wife has always been interested in me, that he will go out of the town immediately. Until I have left their house, he will not come to the house again. Just a casual encounter, and there may be some trouble. The second reason for his antagonism towards me was that his wife has asked me that when a wife ceases to love the husband, is it right to sleep with the man? I said, that is prostitution. One has to be very sincere about it. If you don't love, you have to say it. Don't try to pretend, at least in matters like love. And then she asked me, if the wife loves somebody else, I said, love is the highest love. And you should not be dominated by any lower law of morality, society. When you are following the highest law, nothing goes wrong. And she was asking these questions not just out of curiosity or for somebody else, she was asking for herself. And the husband is angry that I have supported his wife. And he was worried that the wife is already impressed with me, the son is impressed, and the daughter is impressed. So he prevented the son, made it clear that if you become a sannyasin, I will disown you. You cannot help with my money a movement that I don't like. A man who has been disturbing our old tradition, our religion, our morality, and is corrupting the mind of the youth. Now the son has become the director of the Times of India group of papers. and the daughter also associate directors. So they were here, the mother was here, and 70 people from the staff. They insisted that they want their questions to be answered. I agreed seeing a long relationship with their family, but I was surprised when I came in. Those 70 persons were sitting like stone statues. They could not even answer my greeting with folded hands. I was initiating the greeting, but they could not raise their hands. And it was so hilarious that because of those 70 people, the wife, who is really now the owner of the whole thing, because the husband is absolutely a weak person. He cannot do anything that the wife does not want. She is now the queen of the whole empire that they have created. Even she was sitting like a stone statue, worried about those 70 people, that if they see her, and this is a common practice, even on the street if you see a stranger, just to greet him, the only person who greeted me was Sumer, the young man who wanted to become a sannyasi, and the girl Nandita greeted me in a very strange situation. Because on one side was Sumer greeting me just as any sannyasin. In the middle was the mother who was sitting like a dead corpse. And behind them the 70 corpses. The girl wanted to greet me, but she could not go the whole way. She compromised. She just raised her hands this much. She could not bring them together. A compromise. And when all these three saw me the next day, they all touched my feet. People have such public faces and such private faces. But I was really feeling sad for those 70 people. They have come just to listen to me, to their answers, and I devoted the whole meeting to their questions. And if they cannot even greet me, do you think they can understand? The east wind comes, only dead trees will remain static. All the living trees will start going down. And these are the foremost generalists of the country. But with such prejudiced minds, I have answered their questions, but they don't have the guts to publish their own interview in their own newspapers. They are afraid of the government, they are afraid of the public, and perhaps they are afraid of themselves. That what people will say, that you listened all this hammering on the journalists and you could not speak a word, looking at them. Finally, I decided not to look at them, because looking at them was such a pitiable scene. That I simply forget all about them. I looked at my people who are unprejudiced, open, available. And if the east wind comes to them, they will rejoice in its coolness. In India, the east wind has a special symbol, a meaning to it. Because from the east, the coolest wind comes. Very soothing to the heart. Very refreshing to your whole being. But it cannot do anything to a corpse, neither it can give him coolness nor freshness. On the contrary, the corpse will give the cool wind its disgusting foul odor. Buddha is saying it is like one gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. The dharma preached by the Buddha is also like this. If he had had the intent to create benefit in all realms, then this would have been preaching the dharma egoistically. Buddha preaches without any intention. He preaches the way flowers release their perfume, without any intention. Even in the loneliest forest, where nobody ever goes, when the flower opens its petals, it releases its perfume. It is not a question for waiting for somebody to appreciate . It is not intentional, it is spontaneous. Tahui, at least on this point, is right. And he is right perhaps because he himself is teaching with an intent to change people, to create benefit in all realms, and he is becoming a little aware of the fact that he himself does not know it. He has heard about it. And he is clever enough to manage intellectually to give it a form systematized and logical and rational. But one cannot deceive oneself for long. Sooner or later one comes to know that what I am saying is not my experience, because my actions don't show that they are coming from an enlightened being. To want to cause married beings to gain deliverance according to their kind, is not this, after all, impossible? Have not you read how Sariputra, at the assembly where the perfection of wisdom was preached, asked Manjushri, "These two are very intimate disciples of Gautama Buddha, and perhaps the most learned, but they dropped all their learning. The dialogue between them has to be very minutely and very lovingly to be understood, because this is how Buddhist enlightened people have been talking to each other for centuries. This is something special to Buddhism. In no other religion such thing happens. Both are enlightened beings. Sariputra asks, "Don't all Buddhas, the Tathagatas, awaken to the realm of truth?" He knows the answer. But he is simply asking Manjushri, who has just become enlightened. Manjushri said, no. Sariputra, even the Buddhas cannot be found. How could there be Buddhas who awaken to the realm of truth? The question was just to test how deep Manjushri has reached into his enlightenment. And Manjushri shows a tremendous insight. He says, when you become enlightened, you are no more. You don't find a Buddha. You are no more a person anymore. You are only a presence. And when there is no Buddha, how could there be any truth to be found? Who will find it? The seeker, the searcher, the finder is no more. Who will find the truth? Even the realm of truth cannot be found. How could it be realized by the Buddhas? And that which cannot be found certainly cannot be realized. Tahui does not understand the intention of this small dialogue. He thinks, see how those two men spurred each other on this way. They have reached beyond the way. There is no question of being spurred by each other. Sariputra is simply trying to find how much depth is to Manjushri's enlightenment, and he is perfectly satisfied. Because enlightenment means you become only a pretense. And that very presence is the truth. There are not two persons, the finder and the found. The seeker has dissolved. And what has remained is just a pure awareness with no identity, with no personality, with no ego. And this very presence is truth. There is no other truth than your awareness. But Tahui does not say that Sariputra was immensely satisfied that Manjushri has reached the place His question was not a curiosity. His question was to fathom the depth. Manjushri was just gone through the transformation. And this was an usual practice in Buddha's disciples. When somebody will become enlightened, all other enlightened people will ask him strange questions. Not that they don't know the answer, they want to hear the answer from this man who has freshly entered into the eternal source of life. But he has left the dialogue incomplete because Sariputra was overjoyed, and he said to Manjushri, "So you have reached. Now there is nothing more, nowhere else to go. You have found your authentic reality." Because he does not say that. My feeling is he has not understood the purpose of the dialogue. When did they ever set their minds on anything? He cannot yet conceive the space of no mind. He remains in the mind. Once in a while he comes to the very boundary of the mind, but then he again goes back. He does not step out of it. For example, this dialogue would have helped him to come out of the mind. There are no Buddhas in enlightenment. There is no realization of truth in enlightenment, but only a pure presence. A pure life, pure consciousness, but that is what we call the Buddha. That is what we call the truth. But his approach is through the intellect and the mind, so he finishes by commenting, "See how those two men spurred each other on this way. When did they ever set their minds on anything? All the Buddhas and all the patriarchs since antiquity have had a style like this in helping people. They are not helping. The dialogue is not a question of helping because both are enlightened. And there are millions of dialogues so beautiful. I have been thinking sometimes just to talk about those dialogues which have happened between enlightened people. For example, Lingchi is standing on a bridge. With his master. And he says, Master, is it true? Because Buddha says everything is a flux. That we are standing on a bridge which is in a flux. It is dangerous. The river is moving, that is true, but the bridge is not moving. And the master hit Lingchi and told him, you idiot. The river is not moving. The bridge is moving. Meditate over it. And Lingchi had to meditate over it. And recognized in a certain silence that bridge is also moving but very slowly. And to call that river is moving is meaningless because the very meaning of the word river is movement. To say movement is moving is absurd. But the bridge that looks to be stable and permanent is moving. It is getting old. One day it will collapse. It is not a fast runner, very slow movement, so slow that you cannot detect it. He went back to the master and said, forgive me, the river is not moving. The bridge is moving. Because river means movement, so there is no point of saying that it is moving. The real question is the bridge. And the master said, you managed to see in the right perspective. Even mountains are moving. Even stars are moving. Everything is in a flux. Because the river is moving so fast that you can see. That which you can see is not a great realization. until you start seeing that which is happening and you are not aware. It is just that later descendants have lost the essence of the school and set up their own individual sects. He himself belongs to an individual sect. And he is saying it is just that later descendants have lost the essence of the school. He knows it from his very inner feeling. He has also lost the essence, and he has also become part of a sect, making up strange things and concocting marvels. But it seems he is coming a little alert about the situation. There is every possibility, because however asleep a man may be, he is going to awake sooner or later. I would love to see Tahui before he ends his sutras, that I can say to you that he has come home. He wandered much. He went astray many times. He committed grave mistakes. But all that can be forgiven if he comes back home. If he realizes even in the last sutra the essence of enlightenment, then everything else can be forgiven. Man is very frail. Very vulnerable. Tahui is not an exception. When he called Gautam Buddha the barbarian, he was at the farthest point from realization. He was lost in a jungle. To call Buddha a barbarian means there is no hope for man ever. Buddha is a great hope in the sense that he has shown what is hidden in man's being, and he has brought it more clearly than anybody else in the world. Man Bertrand Russell remembers he lived a long life, almost one century, and saw many things happening. A long life of tremendous changes, revolutions, wars. And he was brought up with a very fanatic Christian conditioning. But he was a man of tremendous intelligence and courage. He dropped all that conditioning. Because he looked in the Bible with an open mind, not as a Christian, and he found so many stupid statements that he has to write a book, Why I Am Not a Christian. But he reminds in his autobiography that although I have dropped all my conditioning, but it is an impossible task. Even the conditioning has been dropped, some scratches somewhere have still remained. I became aware of those scratches because when I read Gautam Buddha, I was immensely satisfied that this is the man, the greatest man who has walked on the earth. But then suddenly something in me felt uneasy. How somebody can be a greater man than Jesus Christ? And I was amazed. I was thinking, I am no more a Christian. And he has criticized Jesus on many points, and with such clear logic that no theologian of Christianity has been able to answer it. And I suspect even Jesus may not have been able to answer it. His questions are very clear. For example, he says, Jesus goes on talking about compassion, love, love your enemies, love your neighbors, which is even a more difficult thing. Your enemies live long, far away. You don't have to bother about them the whole time. But the neighbors, they are the very close enemies, continuously harassing you in some way or other. And Christians call him a Prince of Peace. But he finds in the Bible incidents which prove that Jesus was not a man of peace. And in such stupid incidents, he is caught up that there is no way to clean it or to explain it away. One day, they have been hungry, he and his followers, because the town refused to give them anything. And he was so angry that when he came close to a fig tree, it was not the season for figs, and the tree was without any fruits. But he was so blind in anger that he cursed the tree that you will always remain an ugly tree, because the only begotten Son of God has come to you and you are not ready with fruits, no welcome. Bertrand Russell says, I understand intellectually perfectly that Gautam Buddha perhaps is the highest expression. Jesus is no comparison to him. But somewhere deep down, I could not manage. At the most I could do was that both were equal. I cannot put Jesus Christ lower than Gautam Buddha. Knowing perfectly well that Gautam Buddha is far higher, but that is only intellectual understanding. The conditioning goes into the unconscious, and the unconscious becomes restless. Unless you satisfy it, and as he accepted that perhaps they are both of the equal status, the restlessness disappeared. And this is to a man who is very intelligent, a genius, not only about the world, but about himself also. He is watching how his mind functions. His intellect is saying that it is absolutely certain, but his unconscious feels disturbed. And the unconscious is 9 times more than your conscious. And to feel the unconscious disturbed is a kind of sickness, a nausea. To settle it down, he agrees that both are equal, and immediately the restlessness disappears. Tahui is an intellectual, calling Buddha a barbarian. Sooner or later he must have realized that that was going too far and too ugly. I hope that he will come back Even if he can come back at the last moment of his death, everything else can be forgiven. It is human to forgive. The ancient saying is, it is human to err, and it is divine to forgive. I want a little change in it. It is human to err, it is more human to forgive. Why bring divine unnecessarily in? The scientific mind always tries to have as minimum hypotheses as possible. Manisha had asked last night, seeing that Tahui has not proved a great treasure of enlightenment, she had asked that we can finish the discourses on Tahui tonight. I said no, because that will be injustice. I have hammered him. I would like, if he can come back home, to appreciate him also. So I will go through the whole sutras. I don't know what is going to happen in them. But a man who may be an intellectual, if continues, sooner or later, he is going to recognize that he is going round and round in a circle. And there is much more than this continuous circle. But that much more can be seen only if you stand out of the circle as a witness. And I think he is capable. Because everybody is capable. It is only a question when you turn inwards. Only a question when you drop your pretensions and hypocrisies. So I will wait for 2 weeks, he says. There will be sutras for 2 weeks more. If he goes astray, he will get hit. But But my feeling is a man who is interested, may realize at some point that what he is doing is only intellectual gymnastics, and that may prove a turning point in his life. And if it happens, then this whole series on Tahui will be of immense significance, because it will be the story of any man wandering, going astray, coming back to the path, then falling again and again. But at the end, finally, one becomes a light unto himself. I will also feel at ease, because I don't like to hit anybody. If I can see him coming back, with the insight of enlightenment, as his own experience, I will also feel good that the man was worth hitting. You were not hitting just an ordinary idiot. He was extraordinary. I don't know what is going to happen in these 2 weeks. It all depends on Tahui, how many times he is going to astray, and whether he has the potential to realize, or he dies without realization. It will be a sad affair if he dies without enlightenment. I would like it to be a celebration, and my hope is that the man is capable. Any moment the turning point can come, and any moment his inner flame can burn bright. So you will have to tolerate Tahui at least for 2 weeks more.